Welcome to the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, where we interview leaders in cybersecurity. Today, we have an awesome guest. His name is Andrew Wilder. He's a CISO, and he's awesome to talk to. He's a LinkedIn top voice. Let's go to his LinkedIn, actually. Here we are. Check it out. Here's Andrew's LinkedIn. Top information security voice. He's been a speaker at conferences. He's a CISO right now at Community Veterinarian Partners. Been a VP and CISO of several companies. He spent 18 years at Nestle as their regional CISO. This man's seen a lot, and I'm excited to chat with him. He does have a website, cybersecurityintheboardroom.com. He'll talk about it. Here he is. If you want to engage with him, go to his website, connect with him on LinkedIn. He's also big on YouTube. Check it out. Type his name into YouTube. He's all over. He's got like 10 videos, top hits. So I'm excited to talk with Andrew. Here we go. Well, all right. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew Wilder from St. Louis. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Blake. How are you doing? You know, when we met before, you told me that you were a Star Wars fan, and I believed you, but now I really believe you. So you have definitely called my bluff here.
Oh, yeah, in case it wasn't obvious enough. And that's kind of how I asked if you want to be on the podcast. I started by chatting with you about Star Wars, and you told me your birthday is on May the 4th. I'm jealous.
Yes, Blake, May the 4th be with you. You know, the funny thing is I've been a Star Wars fan since I was a little kid, and I didn't realize until my 30s that my birthday was on Star Wars Day, because apparently it wasn't a thing until fairly recently. So, It's great to know that now and be able to celebrate it with everybody on my birthday.
Do you have any birthday traditions that revolve around Star Wars now?
Birthday traditions for Star Wars? I don't know. At least one time, one of my kids got me a Darth Vader koozie for my birthday. I do have a nice koozie collection, and that was a good one. But I don't think I have a specific Star Wars tradition yet, but that might be a good thing to start building.
It may be. I find now that ever since I started this wall in my office, It's very easy for my family to know what to get me for birthday and Christmas now. They just add something to it. So either a Star Wars t-shirt, I'm all for it. If it makes their life easy too, right? They know exactly what to get me. But that leads us into our warm-up question. What is your favorite Star Wars movie or show?
My favorite Star Wars movie or show is the very first one, A New Hope, or Episode 4, if you will. And I gave it a little thought after you and I talked about it, but that one has so many classic lines that we all know today. You know, these aren't the droids you're looking for and things like that. It's just, there's so much good in that one. And look, I really love Empire Strikes Back. I really love Return of the Jedi. I saw those many, many times as a kid too. I love that they started rebooting the franchise again and going through, you know, 1, 2, and 3 and 7, 8, and 9. And I've loved all of those movies as well, but nothing beats for me the classic. You know, the scene when they're in the trash compactor, shut down all the trash compactors on the level or whatever, man, that stuff's awesome to me. I really like that. So.
Yeah. What was he saying? I can't remember now, but that scene is rummaging through my brain right now.
Yep. And they've got that.
Shut down all the things on the detention level.
Yes.
Shut down all the garbage matches on the detention level. Something like that.
The little one-eyed like snake thing is in there trying to eat him and stuff. And
Pretty cool. It was classic, man. Classic. Yeah, it wouldn't be anything without those. But I do really like the Andor series and Rogue One.
Okay.
Kind of the build up to how they steal the Death Star plans. Those turned into my favorite, but can't have those without the classics, of course.
And the shows have been epic. I love that they've done that, and like Baby Yoda and all that stuff. Those are really cool. And I'm very happy that somebody has decided to make one of my favorite childhood movies into this huge thing that has all kinds of shows and movies behind it. It's great.
Well, hey, I noticed that you are a top voice on LinkedIn in the information security space. So kudos to you. I'm curious, do you have like a content strategy or something that you follow or recommend for that?
So I do have one that I recommend to other people. I wouldn't say that I'm really great at following it myself, but I used to listen to this podcast called Boardroom Bound. The guy named Alex Lowry, who was the deputy COO at JP Morgan, I think it was. And he would have on people related to boards, but a lot of times he'd have other kind of side things like recruiters. And then one time he had this LinkedIn expert on. And the LinkedIn expert, they gave this philosophy called the 311 rule. And the 311 rule for LinkedIn posting or any kind of social media posting is that three times within a time period. Now, let's use a week, but you don't have to do it in a week. You can do it in a month or whatever. Three times you post something that's value add to your network. So I'm going to share a recent article about cybersecurity. I'm going to give my insights on it or say something funny or put some good hashtags or tag some people that I know who might be interested in it. And that's going to create a discussion and people are going to find value in that. So that's the three part. So majority of your time is adding value. One is something that's kind of personal. So I spoke at an event or, you know, something happened with my family or something happened with me or I got an award or a certificate or whatever. And then the last thing, the other one, is that one I can ask for something. So whether I'm kind of selling a service or I'm working with a startup and I want people to check them out, whatever. So it's not, I'm not just bombarding people with asks. I'm not bombarding people with personal stuff, but the majority of the stuff that I bring is a value add. So I like that 311 rule, and people that I mentor and stuff, when they say like, hey, what should I post on LinkedIn? I try and give them that rule. And it's a good guideline. You don't have to follow it 100%, but I think it's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to have to rewatch and digest those later, but so, you know, I'm trying to figure out the whole content strategy myself. Right. And starting this podcast is part of that, because prior to this, I felt like, you know, I was putting out content, but it mostly was silly recruiter stuff.
Yeah.
And my audience is other recruiters. That's not going to help me at all. Right.
Nope,
as a recruiter.
Nope.
So this is part of a new strategy to try to attract what's called your ICP or ideal customer profile. And I do love, you know, making placements in the cybersecurity space. And I find that I have a lot of friends. Like I look around in my friends group and a lot of them are in cybersecurity, and I'm like, well, maybe these are my people among the software development community as well. But the only thing though that I'm torn over is that whenever I put up something silly, a little skit, you know, the engagement is way higher than if I put up a little podcast clip that is trying to add value, be serious, you know, give something that would be of value, right?
Yeah.
The engagement's super low. And I'm like, oh man, have you found the same thing?
I think that you're right, but I think if you follow the 311 rule, you might start to see more engagement in the serious things that you're doing. You know, everything that you post gives some kind of a, you know, this is what's valuable to me, this is who I am, something like that. So of course you want to drive engagement and that's good, but I think you want to show people, even if you're getting less engagement, that here's the valuable stuff that I bring. And by the way, every once in a while, I'm going to post something really funny and you're going to love that, but stick with me and I'm going to give you some valuable stuff too.
Good stuff. Yeah. And not that I want to become this or maintain this, because I've heard it's a lot of work, but how did you become a top voice and how do you maintain it? What's going on behind the scenes?
So top voice. So at some point you get selected by LinkedIn to answer questions. So they have these kind of, they're not really articles. They're kind of like a seed of an article, and they'll have a topic like, how do you advance in your career in cybersecurity? And then it'll have like five sections of the article that'll say like, you know, early career or mid career or, you know, mentors or coaches or something like that. And it'll tell you like, which one of those kind of sub bullets do you want to add something to? And if you add things to those articles and then other people like or interact or engage with your comments, and you do that enough times, then you become a top voice in whatever subject you are adding that to. So
yeah, okay.
Apparently people like the stuff that I was saying on those articles enough that it kind of, and there's some sort of algorithm behind it as well, but I did enough of those things and people like them that they made me a top voice.
Very cool. Yeah. I get invited to answer some of those, and I have a couple of times.
Okay.
But sometimes the questions seem like it's like, duh, or maybe my first thought is like, who's asking this? Like, and then they also answer the question for you on the page, you know, the answers are already right there. And it's like, well, I don't need to add to this. They've already answered it. Why are they asking me? They got the answer right there.
Well, maybe you can add some color to it or some humor or something else that'll add more value to the content.
Well, I try to add a little comment, but then it says, I'm not adding enough characters, right? I want to add something short and sweet. And they're like, well, you got to have at least 175 characters or whatever it is. And I'm like, well, I don't have enough to, you know, I can't contribute here, I guess. So next. Well, hey, moving on. So Can you tell us your story? How did you land in cybersecurity?
Well, I've got two versions of the story, and not because I tell the story differently somehow, but I have like a 1 minute version and I have like a 5 minute version. And the 5 minute version goes back to the very beginning, and the 1 minute is kind of more condensed. So it's your podcast, Blake. It's your call.
I want to go back to your childhood. I want to talk about your mom and dad. No, I'm just kidding. You can do the 1 minute version. That'd be fine.
Okay. 1 minute version. So that's pretty easy. I started in cyber and consulting through HP. I worked for three different companies as a consultant in cyber. That was Bank of America, DHL, and Nestle. I got job offers from all three of them as a consultant. I guess I was doing a pretty good job. And I chose Nestle because I fell in love with their culture. I was there for 18 years in progressive leadership roles. Just every 2 or 3 years, I get more scope, more team, more budget, more responsibility. When I left Nestle in 21, I was the regional CISO of Americas, Asia, and Europe. Then I went over to a company called Hillenbrand. It's an industrial manufacturing company. I was a global CISO for them, built their program from the ground up. And since the middle of last year, I have been the retained CISO for a company called Community Veterinary Partners, and also kind of building their program from the ground up as well.
Nice. Now, did you start as like a network engineer or?
Started as really doing projects in cybersecurity around vulnerability management.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. I know there's like 52 different jobs within the cybersecurity space and everybody's looking for a way in, right?
Yep.
And you're in the top spot now as the CISA, right? So kudos to you, man. You made it. The most stressful job in the whole industry. How do you deal with the stress of the job?
How do you deal with the stress? That's a good question. You know, if you let it, the stress can really overwhelm you. So you have to be really conscious of it, and you have to be kind of fighting against it all of the time. My boss, who was the global CISO at Nestle, would remind us all the time, like, we are not the Department of Defense, right? We're a global food company, but you know, it's not like the absolute end of the world. So don't kill yourself trying to do it. Obviously, he wanted us to deliver and deliver well and fast and with quality and all that stuff. But it's a good kind of check yourself reminder. Now, obviously, if you do work for the government, or you work for some other company like a bank or something like that, where you really need to be stringent on it, there's some more stressful things. But if you work for almost any other industry outside of those two, you can always remember that it's a little bit less stressful. Now, I think one of the other ways to combat it is to be really well prepared. You know, they say the best time to plan for an incident is when you're not in the middle of one. So having really good policies, really good procedures that you have rehearsed, that you have written out and agreed upon ahead of time, that really helps you when the stuff hits the fan, so to speak. I'm a big proponent of really good policies, really well written incident response plans and playbooks, and making sure that you execute on those, because that also helps you to not forget really important stuff when you're doing probably the most important part of your job, which is that IR piece.
Good answer. I noticed a bullet point in your LinkedIn. It mentions the fact that you've increased cyber maturity at a company from 52% to 85%. How do you measure that, the cyber maturity?
Yep. So this company is a private equity owned company, and the private equity group has their own cybersecurity assessment tool. It's based on the CIS-18. I've used very similar tools myself, where you just kind of do t-shirt sizes on the CIS-18. You look at the different controls and you rate yourself and you come out with a numeric figure. In fact, back in 2012 at Nestle, I created this thing called the Security and Compliance Index, a very similar process. So we'd look at all 60 of our business units across about 80 different controls, and then we come out with a composite score. So when I started at CVP, they had a, you know, relatively low score, kind of medium score on that. And then we looked at, what is the low-hanging fruit here? Like, what are the key things that we can do the biggest bang for the buck at the biggest amount of value in terms of cyber maturity?
Very cool. You'll have to check that out. What are you focused on lately?
What am I focused on lately? Well, one thing I'm doing a lot lately is working with cybersecurity startups. I think it's a great thing for a few different reasons. Number one is it really helps you to stay on the cutting edge of cybersecurity and technology and what's coming out there. It can be really valuable for a company that you're at, because you can bring in what would be a $100,000 or $500,000 piece of software for like next to nothing, right? Because you get in at an early level, you become a design partner or something like that. And then it's almost like having a highly skilled development team that's working for you that you're paying, you know, peanuts for to get in it. And you can help to influence that and make that product better so that everybody in the industry benefits, because when they finally get the tool, you've been able to put that input into it. And of course, all of those things that you do are valuable for the founders, for the people who work for those companies, to helping them build a better product and help to protect the world with it. So I think those are really fun things to do. And I like working with those different startup companies, and they seem to like working with me. So that's a lot of fun for me as well.
Interesting. Yeah. And the majority of my time working with smaller companies like that, as opposed to the enterprise, but it's a good mix of both. Honestly, there's one company that's caught my attention called Praetorian, and it's a Star Wars reference, right? The Praetorian Guard. And I was like, oh, what a fantastic name for a cybersecurity company. Praetorian, if you're listening right now and you are not getting good talent for the jobs that you have posted, I can help you right now.
Here's your guy.
I would
right
love
here.
To help you.
Blake Williams.
I'm your guy. I'm just meant to partner with your company. So are there any emerging threats that you're seeing that CISOs and cybersecurity teams should really be focused on right now?
Well, Blake, I don't think you could talk about emerging threats today if you didn't talk about the use of generative AI in cybersecurity. So when I look at it, I see three parts of it. Number one is the good part, right? That's the part where you, your cybersecurity team, is using generative AI as a tool to help you to make your tools better, to make your team better, to make those incident response plans better, all of those things. So using it as a positive side. Then you've got the side of the business wanting to use it and how the business uses it securely. If you look at things like people being able to buy a Chevy Tahoe for a dollar by kind of tricking a AI chatbot into it, the business is going, you know, kind of diving headfirst into this thing. And there's some guardrails that we need to help put around it to make it more secure. And then, of course, there's the ugly side of it, which is attackers using it. If I think about it from an attacker perspective, number one attack vector is email, right? And how do you train people to look at phishing email? Well, you know, it has bad spelling, you know, it has bad grammar, all of that stuff, you know, looks weird or whatever. So you look at those things. Using, you know, any kind of large language model, you can create very unique and very professional looking phishing emails that people won't be able to use those kind of standard tricks to find. And it'll make things more difficult for us as practitioners trying to prevent it.
It's going to be impossible, I feel like, because you're right. I mean, about these elaborate phishing campaigns, it was just yesterday I got a text message from my CEO, and she needed my help with something. She was in a meeting. She needed me to buy gift cards, and it was a secret, like, surprise to reward an employee. And it's the third or fourth time I've gotten this same text thread. I'm like, here we go again. So I try to see how far it can go. Of course, they want you to text them photos of the gift card rack. So I just steal a photo off of Google real quick, one that looks like it's from Target or whatever. And I make sure a lot of time's gone by, so I didn't just zip there immediately.
Yeah.
But I mean, eventually I'm just like, hey, I've been messing with you the whole time. Like, how many people fall for this? Do you really want to continue doing this with your life? Like, is there anything you could be doing right now? You're really ruining yourself. Like, you're ruining your mental health by doing this.
Blake, let me tell you a story. I don't think this was scheduled to be part of our podcast, but last month I hosted a conference with the FBI in St. Louis. And we had people from the Secret Service, from CISA. And one guy who is a local police officer in the St. Louis Police Force, who's part of an FBI task force, he talked about a thing called pig butchering. You know about pig butchering?
Never heard it.
So pig butchering comes from a Chinese word, and it refers to fattening up your prey before going in for the slaughter. So they started to investigate where all these pig butchering things are coming from. Now, most pig butchering are romance scams, getting people to invest in some sort of cryptocurrency that's making a ton of money every day, and then letting them see that through fake apps or fake websites, and then getting them to invest their 401k or sell their house or whatever, because they're going to make so much money, and then disappearing at that point after you've stolen everything. But what they found out when they investigated where these attacks are coming from is that there is human trafficking going on in Southeast Asia. They are kidnapping people. They're putting them in these big kind of prison facilities, And for 16 hours a day, they are texting people to buy gift cards. They are doing romance scams. They're doing all this stuff. They showed a picture of a lady's desk with like 18 different cell phones on it, all of them open to WhatsApp or iMessage or whatever. And they're all doing these scams all over the place to people all over the world. So when you're texting back with someone, it's probably somebody in Southeast Asia or something like that who's being forced to do this to try to extract money from us.
That's awful. That thought never occurred to me that they were being forced to do it. Yeah. And some of the replies were kind of vicious. They were like trying to pretend that they were my CEO getting upset with me for disagreeing to, and not agreeing to do what they say. Yep. And they were like, even going to the point where they said I was fired, but it had never occurred to me that they probably had, you know, they're being forced to do this. They've got 18 phones in front of them. They get replies. They have a script. Yep. They follow the script. That's crazy. And the deep fakes are crazy too. Last year, there was somebody in my family who was fooled by a deep fake AI generated keynote speech that Elon Musk was doing. Mm-hmm. And he was on stage talking about this AI day trader bot. And the person that I'm talking about was actually in the process of hooking up with whoever was on the other end in a WhatsApp chat. And I'm like, wait, WhatsApp? Delete it. Delete everything. Stop talking. And I'm just like, wow, what percentage of people are falling for this stuff? Because to somebody that has an eye for it, you can spot it. I mean, any little thing, you know, how they spell something, you know, something doesn't make any sense, but obviously it's working on a large percentage of people or they wouldn't be doing it.
They wouldn't keep doing it if it didn't keep working. And if you think about your parents or your friends who are not in information technology or whatever, I mean, you can see how people could fairly easily fall for it.
What are your predictions for just the rest of this year?
The rest of this year? Well, I think we're going to see a proliferation of additional breaches and attacks. It's going to keep happening. You saw recently the United Healthcare one. There was a double extortion ransomware that was being done on them. So, you know, you've heard of, you know, ransomware, but then they'll go back and say, oh, yeah, now you've already paid well. Now we're going to do something else with your data. I think that'll continue to happen. I think we'll see things around quantum starting to come to play. You're seeing that technology get cheaper. And there's been articles that I've read about nation state attackers that have been stealing encrypted data for years, knowing that once they get quantum decryption, they can then take that data that they stole over the last few years, even though it's encrypted, and then decrypt it using quantum decryption. So how do we start to use quantum well? How do we encrypt ourselves with that and all the change that's going to happen there? So those are the big things that I see. And beyond that, I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff around data security. If you look at CIS-18 that we talked about before, number three there is data. So protecting your data, knowing where your data is all the time, and those identities that manage that data, whether it's, you know, SaaS or kind of non-SaaS or non-human identities, how are you looking at the way that that data is being protected?
How often should people change their password?
That's a controversial question. So when you force people to change their password, you end up getting sequential passwords usually. Like they've done studies to show now you'll just say, well, my password is Blake Williams rules 1234. And then next week it'll be—
How'd you know that?
Blake Williams rules 5678 with an exclamation point at the end. So what you don't want to do is force people to have sequential passwords. So my take on it is people only need to change their passwords if there's any indicator that a password has been compromised. The strongest passwords that you have are the ones that you know that are long and strong. And that's probably the one that you use to get into your password vault or you use on your personal machine at home or something like that. So you want to make sure that you have some good, long, strong passwords. And besides that, use a password manager. And then if there's any indication that things are compromised, then you rotate those. But that's it. And if you ask me for my password for 99% of accounts, I have no idea what it is. It's in my password manager. It's a long random string of characters that I have no idea what it is.
Oh, okay. So you're not even making them up. You're letting them—
I'll do a password generator and do a 99 character, you know, just completely random. No one's going to guess that.
Oh, wow. Okay. I've seen those and I'm like, no, I'll never remember that. But then I guess that's the wise thing to do.
That's the point of it. And it autofills on your browser or it autofills on your phone. So I don't have to remember it. It's just going to autofill it for me.
Right. Good point.
And the future of that really is pass keys. YubiKeys are great, right? Those things that are hardware-based token. So like the things that I really need to protect, I put those with YubiKey protection, and then I have to plug in the device. I have to touch it. So it has to be me and it has to be a physical thing. So even if somebody was somehow able to get into something, they'd have to have that physical device, which unless they steal it from me, they don't have.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about the quantum computing, quantum decryption. So it's like a password that might have been stolen in some data breach 10 years ago or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm still using that password. It may just be a sitting duck out there waiting to be decrypted and hacked.
You know about this website called Have I Been Pwned?
No, never heard of it.
Free website developed by a guy who I think still works for Microsoft. A really great guy. And what he does is he takes all the data from public data breaches and he puts it into his database. Now, it's not searchable for an attacker, so I can't go in and say, give me everybody's password. But you can go in, you can enter any of your email addresses and see if those have been involved in any kind of public data breach. And then if they have, of course, you want to change the password that you're using on that account. Obviously, never reuse passwords, right? Don't use the same password for any other access that you have. But that's a good website, not only for you, but for all your listeners to go. You can check out your accounts there. And in fact, you can check out your password there. So you can type your password in and let it see if it shows up in any of the password breach databases.
Okay. We'll have to have Jamie pull that up post-production. Yeah. Talking about security tools and websites and things like that, what are some of your favorite security tools?
My favorite security tools, I talked about working with startups. If you go to RSA, I'm going to answer the question in a weird way. If you go to RSA, the most interesting thing that you can go to is like the startup throwdown or the startup challenge. Because what you see there, those are the problems that are being solved right now at the cutting edge of cybersecurity. So favorite tools are going to be ones that are coming. And my favorite tool today is not going to be my favorite tool next month or 6 months from now or whatever. Now, my go-to sources of information are CISO groups. I'm very fortunate to be in a number of really awesome CISO groups, and they share information with each other all the time. And the great thing is you can go there and ask a question. If I'm looking for a new piece of software, that's where I'm going to go. I'm going to go to one of my CISO groups. I'm going to say, what are you guys using for email security, and see what people come back with. That's the best way that I find to get information. But my favorite way to stay up to date on cybersecurity is a guy named Brian Krebs. Ever seen Brian Krebs before? Brian Krebs is like the most hard-hitting cyber reporter that's out there. He always has great stuff, and he brings it before other people do. And he gets personally targeted by hacker groups because he's calling them out and showing the stuff that they're doing. So a really interesting guy, brave guy, like taking it for everybody else. Love Brian Krebs, big fan.
Interesting. Yeah, he's a Robin Hood of cybersecurity community. I have to maybe try to get him on the podcast.
You should. You should do that.
Krebs, if you're listening, you're invited. You're getting a LinkedIn message right now, matter of fact. Do you have any advice for entry-level cybersecurity career seekers?
Sure. I always have advice for entry-level cybersecurity career seekers. First of all, congratulations. Thank you for joining us. You're going to be happy that you did. It's a great, great field to be in. The first thing I encourage people to look at is go beyond pen tester or SOC analyst, because many, many entry-level cyber people that I talk to and mentor, that is what they're going for. So if you look at things that are outside of that, you can set yourself apart. You want to be in GRC, asset management, disaster recovery, cloud security, application security. These are ways that you can set yourself apart from many other candidates that are trying to get into the field. The second thing is get experience in any way that you can, whether it's projects that you're doing at school, projects that you're doing yourself that you can show, you know, you have a GitHub page or something, go and do free internships, give free cybersecurity services to local businesses, nonprofits, people that need it, that have a mission that you agree with. And if you can, get a paid internship or an apprenticeship or something like that, because experience is key here, right? Many entry-level cybersecurity jobs are requiring like 3 years of experience. And how do you get that if you can't get that first entry-level job? So go get experience any way that you can, and then look at the things outside of just the standard SOC analyst pen tester.
Great advice. If you're building a cybersecurity team from scratch at a new company, what would your ideal team look like?
What would my ideal team look like? So I've had the most success with the most diverse teams. And not just diversity in terms of ethnic diversity, but diversity in terms of thought, experience level, all of those things. So one thing that I would do is I would start by building an internship program. Interns are great for a number of different reasons. One is it's a great talent pipeline because those folks come in, they learn, they do stuff, they meet the team, they go on and graduate, and then they come back and join, and they already have that kind of knowledge of everything that's going on. I would also build an apprenticeship program. Because apprentices are great. They're people who are career pivoting. They're hungry for it. They're excited. They really want to do it. And again, you can get them for significantly less price. The other thing that I would look at is an international security team. So you can hire just as much of talented resources as you can in the US, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, and you can get really good resources that cost a lot less money. And if your budget for security team is based on money, you can get two or three or even four times as many resources by sourcing people internationally. And because we all work remotely, or many people work remotely, there's an opportunity there. Obviously, you'll probably need some good, you know, boots on the ground, get some good leaders in there as well. And for me, a lot of it is about cultural fit, people fit, team fit, that kind of thing. Those soft skills that you either have or you don't. Are you going to show up on time? Are you going to be excited? Are you going to want to learn new things? Those are things that you either have or you don't have. I can teach you how to be a good cybersecurity professional, but you got to show up. You got to be excited. You got to be ready to learn. So that would be my ideal team, I guess.
Very good. Now, it's hard to be very well-rounded in the cybersecurity space because there's so many different jobs. How do you typically differentiate between the job duties when it comes to your standard cybersecurity engineer and then application security engineer and then the term DevSecOps engineer? Yeah. When does it become a DevSecOps engineer?
A lot of times people who work on application security are people who worked on application development before, and they have some kind of an aptitude for security. So they understand the development side, and they can help other developers understand how to make it more secure. I think when you talk about a DevSecOps person, a lot of times DevSecOps are different teams, right? You have developers and you have security, AppSec security people, and you have operations people. But you can have people who are cross DevSecOps engineers. And what you do there is you kind of cross-pollinate. So I remember at Nestle, a guy who said, I really want to be a DevSecOps engineer. So we put him in the ops side for a while. We put him on the dev side for a while. He was already from the security team. So he got to kind of develop that. And that helps people be more well-rounded and develop empathy for their peers, because now they understand by, you know, spending a day in your chair or in a day in your shoes or whatever, figuring out what it is that you do. So they understand how to better work together, I think.
What are your thoughts about the current job market in 2024?
It's interesting. I would also say it depends on who you ask as to what kind of response you will get. I think cybersecurity jobs are healthy right now. You see a number of them being posted. There's a number that was given by a cybersecurity training company some years ago of 4 million open cybersecurity jobs. And this number is often given to people who are looking to get into the industry. I'm not sure that that number is totally accurate. I'm just going to leave it at that. So I see there are more positions being posted. Are all of those real positions? I'm not totally sure. Sometimes you can play games to like say, oh yeah, I'm going to post this job and never really end up executing on it. But I think it's a healthy market. I think if you have the right skill set and you're willing to look for the right things and do the right things, I think you can find it. Obviously, there's more people at the higher level of skilled cybersecurity people who are looking for jobs, but it's an interesting place today. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I found it interesting. Yesterday, I was chatting with somebody on LinkedIn, a contact of mine from a major Fortune 500 company here in North Carolina, and I was on their website. They've got 1,500 jobs posted, wow. A lot of them in cybersecurity. And I've got a ton of candidates right now. So I was trying to let them know, hey, you know, if you guys are struggling on this one and this one, I've got six people right now. And he just replied back, hey, man, we're on a freeze. The last 2 weeks, we've been on a hiring freeze and all of our projects have been put on hold. I'm actually looking for a job right now. And you wouldn't believe how often that I hear stuff like that. Yeah. Is I'm out trying to open up doors, land new clients. And the number one response I get is, hey, actually, I'm looking for a job. And it's awful right now.
Yeah. Especially in large companies, that hiring freeze thing is very common. I've seen a lot of these reorgs where, you know, really talented, skilled people are getting laid off because they're outsourcing things or commercializing things or whatever. So it's that part is definitely hard.
Yeah. Hopefully the layoffs are over, but I have a big fear that they're going to continue. But I'm trying to stay positive, you know. Let's stay positive. No negative thoughts. No negative thoughts. So I love talking about the movie Leave the World Behind because it had such a big impact on me. I like spent a bunch of money trying to prep for the end of the world, you know, after seeing that. And it was so concerning. Have you seen the movie and do you have any thoughts about it?
I wasn't a huge fan of the ending of it. Like, it was a really interesting movie, right? You're like, what's going on here? Really cool stuff. Didn't love the ending very much. I think they could have done that better. But that happens a lot of times in really good movies where they're just not sure how to really end it properly. But it definitely made you think. I didn't run out and buy a bunch of Doomsday Prepper stuff, but it was a thinker for sure and very interesting. And my wife and I really enjoyed watching that one.
If you have to guess, what do you speculate happened between the board at OpenAI and Sam Altman to cause the chaos there for that happen?
I'm going to blame it on like bad board governance. I've taken a lot of courses and read a lot of books in the last probably 2 or 3 years on board governance. Another different question you could ask about that is what happened with the board at that, the one with the lady from Stanford who made that blood testing technology,
right? Yeah.
And if you looked at that board, it was loaded with people who are like really good. And all of them were kind of buying this thing. So I think it had to do with bad governance, right? Like not following the processes right, not doing the right things. I guess I don't have a great story on why that happened, but I think it's due to bad governance, if you ask me.
Yeah, it just worries me because they're so cagey about it. And I've even watched them on podcasts and he just kind of brushes over it, you know, no details. And I'm like, wait a minute, do you guys, I feel like they discovered something and, you know, it hasn't been released yet or anything, but they discovered something and it's going to have a massive impact. And they're arguing over what they're going to do about it, how they're going to handle it. And, you know, whether it's AGI or not, just gets my mind racing. Yeah, my inner conspiracy theorist, you know, I'm actually afraid that AI eventually, all the jobs are going to be taken. The robots are going to take over. And I mean, all the unemployed people, what are we going to have left to do? I mean, we're going to revolt and wage war against them, just like in the movie Dune, right? The story. And what happens there? They destroy all the AI. They make it illegal to have it, period.
Yeah.
And I mean, at some point, what are we going to do with ourselves? I mean, I feel like we may just end up playing video games and being each other's therapist. What I mean, everything else is going to be done by the AI. A lot of companies right now, they struggle with their interview process. They add 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, personality tests and the technical, you know, live coding exercises. And, you know, now we're going to do the on-site interviews. In your opinion, what is the best interview process that nets the best results for both parties?
I like the question. I will say usually within a couple of minutes, I can tell whether or not someone's going to be a good fit for the team or not. I think the best interview process is a recruiter that understands the role. And that's a challenging thing to say from the beginning. So finding a recruiter that understands the role to be able to ask those right kind of screening questions.
I've never had that problem. I don't know. But yeah, maybe someone else will relate.
and then I think what you want to do is a hiring manager interview as the first one. And then after the hiring manager interview, what I like to do is a peer interview. So people that would be peers to this person, being able to ask them technical questions. And then if you're in an organization where you want to do and it also depends on the role too, right? I mean, if you're going for a CISO role, you're probably going to talk to the CFO or general counsel or the CEO, depending on the role and its placement in the organization. So then after you've gone through those couple of levels, then going to that one. I don't think it needs to be drawn out. In fact, I've also seen people do all of the rounds of interviews like in one afternoon. So you come on site, you've already done the screening with HR, then you meet the hiring manager, you meet some peers, then you go talk to the CFO or what have you, and then they can make a decision by the end of the day. I've done some of these personality tests and aptitude tests and stuff like that it's kind of stressful for the candidate. You know, you want to make sure that you do really well on it. Does it really help or does it really do much of a big deal? I mean, I've always passed them and got on to the next part of the interview. So, and usually they won't give you your results either. So that's kind of frustrating. Like, tell me how well I did. I want to know. A lot of the feedback that I hear from my peers, especially going for CISO roles, is that they've done like 15, 20 rounds of interviews and then not getting selected. And then how much time have I invested and how difficult was that for me? And I don't know. I mean, fortunately for me, I've never gone through 15 or 20 different rounds, but that's too much. If you're doing that, you're not making decisions well.
Yeah, the most I've ever seen is 11. So 15, 20.
11 sounds pretty good.
I would have bowed out. If I try to encourage companies to keep it to two or three.
Two or three is totally reasonable. Yeah. I mean, plus maybe an HR screener or something, but yeah.
There you go. A wrap-up call with HR to talk about benefits and working at the company and answering questions and stuff like that. We don't really count that as an interview, but you can. It's a step.
It's a step in the process, yeah.
It is. But yeah, if it goes beyond five steps, honestly, I typically just bow out. You know, I don't want to be a part of it. I already know what kind of nightmare that's going to be. Let another recruiter work on that.
It gives you insight into how that company makes decisions. So if you're going in for a CISO role and you've got to do 15 or 20 interviews, imagine when you want to buy, you know, $1 million piece of software. How many hoops are you going to have to jump through for that?
Right. So, bureaucracy city, for sure. And that's what a lot of candidates complain about, especially at the larger organizations. You don't really hear about that at the small startups, but how do you typically retain security talent? Like, what keeps them happy and engaged at a company?
Yep. So one of my best retainer programs has been development plans. So giving people, I devote 10% of my team's time to development, and that's working time, right? Not, you know, Friday afternoon or whatever, but, you know, whether it's a chunk of time where you're going to go to a boot camp or something like that, or whether it's time per day or something, however works best for you. But knowing that you have a development plan and that in a certain amount of time, you're going to get a certification or you're going to get a diploma or whatever it is, that keeps people engaged. And people don't want to walk away from that. I've seen that as a very powerful talent retention plan. And anytime HR balks and says they don't want to pay for that, I remind them like, look, well, we cannot pay for that. But then you tell me how much it's going to cost to hire for this position again, because now we're going to have a chance that this person's going to leave because we don't have a retainer program with them. And I think everybody should have talent development as part of, you know, as part of their job. But if you don't, then you as a leader can go implement it in your team and you can help to create your own retention plan for your own people.
Yeah, I agree. The development plan is key, and having a well-defined roadmap for the career progression at your company is key, so people don't have to find that elsewhere. You have to think about it for a long time. Like, in this particular role, what is the career path at our company and where can they go from here? And you kind of have to make it an indefinite thing. I mean, even if it's just a changing your title from principal to consultative cybersecurity engineer, right? I mean, people feel like they need something every 2 years. I feel like you get the 2 year itch where, hey, my role hasn't changed and I haven't learned anything new. I feel stuck. I feel like I've plateaued. You have to be able to overcome that at your company and not force people to go elsewhere because they feel stuck. And I talk to people having that problem all the time. They feel the 2 year itch. They want to know what else is out there. Right now, I'm like, now's not a good time. You know, just let's wait until after, especially if they're at a stable company. I'm like, you sure? You sure you want to step into the 2024 job market? I don't know.
There's a couple of good things, Blake, that I borrowed from Nestle. One is they had a program that they called the triple career path. So most people think that the career path is a leadership career path, right? You're going to be a team lead or a supervisor or a manager or a director or whatever, and that's how you're going to go through the organization. But Nestle said, look, there's three ways that you can progress in your career. One is through the traditional leadership path. The other one is what they call the expert path. So you could go to an analyst, to a specialist, to an expert, to an architect, something like that. So you have that pathway that people can go down. And maybe there's different levels in there too. And then the other one was a project related path. So maybe you could be a project analyst or a project manager or a program manager or program director, something like that. So looking at that from those three angles. And the other thing that we did is we tried to give people, and we talked about this before in the DevSecOps part, we tried to give people breadth of experience as well as depth. So, you know, hey, you've been a cybersecurity analyst for a couple of years. Let's go put you into the development team and see how that goes there. And once you give people that really well-rounded understanding, then it's much easier for them to advance up, being able to see how the whole organization works together.
Agreed. Yeah, that reminds me of the apprenticeship program that you were talking about earlier. And I feel like a lot of companies are missing the boat there. They have the internships, but not the apprenticeships. And I'm just wondering how, you know, we can kind of grow that or how you can set that up. Is it like a monthly rotation and a one-on-one based on how many employees that you have in the department, or can one employee take on multiple mentorees, right? I bet they're struggling with how to even set that up.
Yeah. So there's a few ways to kind of get past those boundaries. One is you can use your internship program to also be an apprenticeship program. So you can work with companies that do cyber apprenticeships and bring those in. The other way that you can do it is you can bring them in as contingent labor, right? So just like you're doing contractors today, you can bring in an apprentice as a contractor. It works the same way. You can also bring them in as an employee for a short period of time or something like that. So, you know, HR a lot of times will try and put blockers on things like that. But a great reminder of why apprenticeships are so powerful is a lot of companies have these DEI initiatives, right? And they're trying to build a diverse talent pipeline. And internships and apprenticeships are amazing ways to build that diverse talent pipeline and bring people into your organization who normally would never come into your organization. And it's just a different way to bring people in. And look, if they don't work or you don't like them, you can find somebody else or swap them out or whatever. That certainly happens. But it's a great pipeline, a great tool to get people in at a reasonable cost and then help them build on their career.
Agree. Yeah, the whole contract to hire concept is very popular. And at some points in my career, that's all I've done. Most recently doing more perm than anything, but my company JobBot, we're making a big push right now. We want to hire 1,000 consultants this year for contract consulting gigs. And I feel like that's going to dominate the market, the contract jobs versus the full-time jobs, because companies are going to be kind of skittish on hiring permanent employees for their projects because they don't want to have these big layoffs later. So contract resources are going to win now. So it's a way to stay in the game. You know, as a candidate, be open to contracts right now.
Agreed.
I know we're pushed for time here. It's been fun, man. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. This is podcast number 4. So I'm still a rookie, but this was fun, man. I've enjoyed it. How can people find you and learn more about you?
Well, the easiest way to connect with me is on LinkedIn, Andrew Wilder. I'm pretty easy to find there. I also have a website. It's called cybersecurityintheboardroom.com. So you can go see all the podcasts that I've done. You'll be on there pretty soon, Blake. So a fun way to engage with the content that I've created.
All right. Yeah, I have to check that website. Jamie will put it up. He'll have it right across the top here for us.
Sounds good. I look forward
to that. I've enjoyed it. Well, I hope to have you on again sometime. Whenever I'm made it to level 2 in the podcasting world, you know, if we've advanced to more like 1,000 views instead of 100 views, we got to start somewhere, right?
That's right. I appreciate it, Blake. Have a great day.
All right, you too, buddy. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.